Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. Later on in this hour, we'll be talking to San Francisco City Attorney David Chu and Assemblymember Damon Connolly about how the Bay Area is preparing for the next Trump administration. And later, we'll be joined by Louisa Smith from Book Passage, who has the perfect recommendations for the book lover on your holiday shopping list. But first, the 29th United Nations Climate Conference of the Parties, or COP29, as it's called, recently concluded, and we have with us tonight two Bay Area folks who participated and just returned. The first is Louise Bedsworth, who is my colleague and executive director at the Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment, or CLE, at UC Berkeley Law. Welcome, Louise.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
And we also have Isabel Ruick. Isabel hails from Marin County, currently attends the Yale School of the Environment, and served on the negotiating team for the island nation of Vanuatu. Welcome, Isabel.
Hi, Ethan. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. It was great to have you both. And Isabel, let me start with you. So first of all, can you just tell us how you became part of the negotiating team for the small, for a small island nation like Vanuatu at COP29?
Of course, as you said, I'm a first-year master's student at the School of Environment at Yale, really studying international climate policy. It's what I'm super passionate about, and Vanuatu has been a longtime champion of international climate policy, particularly loss and damage, which describes the impacts of climate change that can't be averted or avoided by adaptation. And so it was honestly such a privilege to work with them and to support their loss and damage team of negotiators, to learn from them. It was a really incredible experience to work with people who have such a wealth of knowledge in this field and who are so passionate about it.
I'm sure that was a remarkable opportunity. I'd love to hear more about it, but Louise, I want to turn to you. And what was your role at this year's COP?
So at CLE and across a number of universities, we often attend COP in an observer status. So we're there to observe the negotiations. We're not participating, but we are engaging with the various parties, as well as a number of other organizations are there. So learning about policy developments, technology developments, and sharing the work that we're doing.
And Louise, I know from having attended in the past, I know you've been to a number of these, that the California delegations typically get a warm reception. They're basically the sort of the rock stars of the climate world. I'm wondering if this year was any different, perhaps more magnified, given the fact that Donald Trump just got reelected.
Yeah, absolutely. I think California had a strong delegation this year that spanned both weeks of the conference and was definitely warmly received. The California delegation travels with the U.S. Climate Alliance, which is an association of states committed to reaching carbon neutrality by the middle of the century. And so they really placed a strong showing for subnational governments. So governments like states and cities and regions and provinces really demonstrating the progress that's being made, as well as the important role and the need to recognize the actions of state and local governments. And so California's Secretary of Natural Resources actually addressed the opening plenary session on behalf of subnational governments. And so for, you know, definitely a strong showing, and I think really continuing to be leaders in demonstrating climate progress, but then also advocating on behalf of cities and states and provinces and regions.
And I'm sure California's role is going to be even more magnified in the coming years once the Trump team takes office. Now, for the third year in a row, the UN's climate conference here has been held by a petrostate. Last year, it was in United Arab Emirates, and before that, in Egypt. This year, of course, Azerbaijan. And I understand there were over 1,700 fossil fuel lobbyists registered for COP29. Oil rigs apparently were visible from the conference venue. And really, just a question for you both, but Isabel, I'll start with you. How did that affect, or did it affect, the mood and maybe the productivity of the proceedings? How did it affect, particularly for you, Isabel, since you were leading a negotiating team? Did that come into play at all?
Yeah, to be honest, I don't necessarily think it did. I think that the success of the COP presidency really all comes in the preparation that's done in the year in advance. When we talk about the Paris Agreement, part of the reason that was so successful is because of the commitment and time that the French presidency put into that, into bilaterals that they were organizing with other member states and other parties. So I really think that COP is an opportunity to kind of shine a spotlight on what countries are doing domestically. And honestly, sometimes petrostates are uniquely positioned to push for more progressive outcomes because they can leverage bilateral positions that they have, like the UAE did in talking to Saudi Arabia at COP28. I think it actually is an opportunity to invite more people into the conversation because whether you like it or not, like this is a global issue and we need all voices on board. So I think it really is an opportunity to welcome more people in.
And Louise, what did you make of the petrostate venue? Did that affect things from what you were seeing as an observer?
Yeah, I think I would really agree a lot with what Isabel said. I think, I know there were a number of people who didn't want to attend or, but at the end of the day, we need everyone to be part of the solution. And I do think having these countries host is important. It can bring new voices to the table. I think you also saw, the CEO of Exxon taking a leadership role, saying he doesn't think that the United States should pull out of the Paris Agreement, which is of course something President Trump did in his first term as president. So I think it does provide a platform and an opportunity to really start the dialogue that we have to be having. We're not going to make progress by leaving the fossil fuel industry out of these conversations.
And I know that there were some significant agreements that did come together, although expectations, of course, were very tempered, I think partially because of the petrostate in charge here. I should call it Azerbaijan. It's got other names besides petrostate. But I want to talk about some of the agreements that came out of it. And the one that got perhaps the most attention this year was a pledge by wealthy countries to contribute $300 billion annually by 2035 to help lower-income countries address the threats and the impacts of climate change. But there was a lot of criticism of this agreement. And Isabel, just to start with you, since you represented a small developing country, how did the smaller island countries like Vanuatu react to this pledge?
I think, that's a great question. I think that no one left COP29, which was kind of coined the finance COP, happy. I think that developing countries, small island developing states like Vanuatu, definitely wanted and expected more when it comes to climate finance. And I think that developed countries also wanted the number to be lower. Does it meet the needs of developing countries? Absolutely not. But I think that developed countries would say that that was the goal, that it's simply to support that action. So I think that that was definitely people left not wanting or not having gotten what they wanted. And I think that it's definitely disappointing, but it also means that we really need to turn to other sources of funding, particularly the private sector, to really drive up those investments and make sure that we're not just mobilizing finance, but actually providing it. Because access to finance when it comes to small and developing states is critical. If there's money available, but it's not accessible, that doesn't mean anything. So we really need to be focusing on access and then what kinds of finance are available. It really needs to be grants, not these loans that are being lended at really unfair lending practices. So I think that should be the priority moving forward. But I think overall, no one left kind of feeling like they got what they wanted.
And Isabel, what kind of aid right now do these small island nations need? Is it really just a guard against sea level rise? I mean, some of these island nations are essentially facing a type of extinction if the seas rise as much as scientists predict that they may.
Yeah, these threats to small island developing states are really national security threats, and people are experiencing climate change every day. I personally can't speak to that, but it was such a privilege being able to support negotiators and people from Vanuatu who are working on the ground. I think the work that they're doing is honestly so impressive, especially when it comes to the new National Loss and Damage Fund that Vanuatu is working on. There are plenty of opportunities for investment. I know that there's been a lot of local and national work on increasing their absorptive capacity so that when finances are available, they can really make sure that they're taking advantage of those. But I think there are opportunities for countries like the US and others to really invest in cleaner energy sources and help support that transition. We're definitely seeing that China is playing a larger role in Vanuatu, and it's really a time for other countries to be stepping up too. This is a much needed just energy transition. And I think Vanuatu is really going full steam ahead and making great progress.
And Louise, I want to ask you also your take on this pledge. I know India, just as one example, they actually opposed the adoption of this agreement because they considered that pledge for help to lower income nations so inadequate. What did you make of that pledge? Is there any glimmer of optimism here, hope? Was it a productive outcome considering all things going on at the conference this year?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's true that no one was really satisfied by the outcome, and it is not a significant amount of money when you consider the magnitude of the problem. But I do think it's opening the conversation that we need to be having about the costs of climate change and how we are going to get the money in place to respond. How are we going to mobilize all sectors of the economy to help especially developing countries address these risks where they are going to be experiencing them most severely? So I think it's a start, but certainly a conversation that needs to continue and I think expand so that we can really be thinking about how are we using all of these institutional structures that were developed before we had the risk of climate change to be able to be responsive and, you know, and they need to adapt themselves to support countries as climate change worsens.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Louise, I also want to ask about another agreement, which was an agreement on a global carbon market. Of course, California has a cap and trade market already established. Wondering if you could just talk very briefly, because we're just running short on time here, about how such a market would work. What was in that agreement?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's another really important start of a conversation. I think putting a price and sending a market signal around carbon and the costs of carbon is really, really important. So I think that's an important step. How that gets worked out, how it gets implemented and designed to protect against all of the challenges in designing a carbon market will be critically important. And I think, yeah, when you look at California, we have a functional cap and trade, you know, a highly functional cap and trade system. It is very robust. It is got strong measurement verification mechanisms. It has tight controls on how offsets are used. And so I think that is, you know, we need to look at these well-functioning markets with the appropriate guardrails and rules and structures in place and think about how we can apply that more broadly.
And Isabel, it looks like the Trump administration is likely to pull out of these climate negotiations, as happened with the first Trump administration. Any predictions or thoughts about what you think the incoming Trump administration is going to do in next year's COP and what the role the United States and subnational entities like California might play?
I think there are really three options, three main options when it comes to what the Trump administration is due. They could, like you just said, withdraw from the Paris Agreement, which would take about a year to come into effect, meaning that they would still be present at COP30 in Belém in Brazil next year. They could withdraw from the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change as a whole, which I think would be really devastating. And others have really advised that the Trump administration not do that. Or they could stay in and really push Trump's kind of anti-climate agenda. With any of these options, I think it really is an opportunity for more state leadership like we're seeing in California. I'm so proud to be from California, to be from the Bay Area, to have lived in Marin. I think that we really need more of that rock star leadership that you spoke to earlier that Louise commented on, because it really is going to come to more subnational efforts to ensure that we don't fall behind and to make sure that we're really leaving no one behind.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you both so much for joining us. Louise Bedsworth, Executive Director at the Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment at UC Berkeley Law. Thank you for joining us here.
Thank you, Ethan.
And of course, Isabel Ruick, Yale School of the Environment grad student and negotiator for the country of Vanuatu. Thank you so much for joining us on State of the Bay. And coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll talk to California Assembly member Damon Connolly and San Francisco City Attorney David Chu about how California is preparing for the next Trump administration. That's right after the break, so stay with us.
Join us for Your Legal Rights Wednesday evenings at 6. Host Jeff Hayden and guests cover a wide variety of legal topics and issues, from tax tips to landlord-tenant issues, discrimination and workers' rights on the job, as well as broader constitutional issues. That's Your Legal Rights every Wednesday evening at 6, here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area, and online at kalw.org.
Hi, I'm Rose Aguilar, host of Your Call. Join us on Mondays at 7 p.m. for an ongoing series on Project 2025. This Heritage Foundation-led plan lays out an agenda to transform the country into a Christian nation. Project 2025 would dismantle the administrative state and ensure arch-conservative rule for decades to come. It would affect all aspects of life and would be implemented by expanding presidential powers and eliminating federal agencies. Join us on Mondays at 7 p.m. here on KALW.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. Bay Area counties are bracing themselves for the potential impact next year when the Trump administration 2.0 takes the reins of key federal agencies. Deportations, restricted access to healthcare, and budget cuts are all on the table, among other issues. Federal dollars allocated for education, high-speed rail, healthcare, and environmental measures like electric vehicle tax credits are all on the chopping block. And today, Governor Gavin Newsom convened a special session in the state legislature to talk about how California will be preparing for the next Trump administration. And joining us tonight to talk about those preparations are State Assemblymember Damon Connolly. Welcome, Assemblymember Connolly.
Thank you. Great to be here, Ethan.
And we're also pleased to be joined by San Francisco City Attorney David Chu. Welcome back to State of the Bay, City Attorney Chu.
Thanks for having me back on. Good evening.
And we want you, our listeners, to be part of this conversation as well. How are you thinking that the Bay Area might be impacted by the next Trump administration policies? What would you like to see done to prepare the Bay Area for this change in administration? You can email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org and send in your questions or comments that way. So to kick off the conversation, I want to play a clip of Governor Newsom talking about why he called for a special session of the legislature today. So let's hear that.
We are calling and have called for an emergency special session of our state legislature, firmly focused on the values we hold dear that I think are universal values, that are American values, as it relates to freedoms and individual liberty, as it relates to the issues of reproductive freedom in particular, as it relates to the freedom to breathe clean air and drink clean water, and environmental stewardship, planting firmly our feet as it relates to continuing to advance our low carbon green growth strategies. To do the same as it relates to vulnerable communities, we're not going to shrink and we're not going to shy or fall prey to the rhetoric around demeaning and belittling vulnerable communities, scapegoating vulnerable communities. We're going to have their back. We're going to have your back. Even if you don't live in the state of California, we're going to have your back.
All right. That was Governor Newsom kicking off the special session today. Assemblymember Connolly, I understand that you attended that in the state legislature. Can you talk about how it went? What were some of the outcomes of the proceedings today?
I did, and we would be happy to. Just so your viewers are clear, we actually convened a special session today, but it was also actually the day where the entire legislature got sworn in for a new two-year session. So there was a lot of excitement. Would love to note that that this is the most diverse legislature in the state's history. We have more women serving now than ever. We've virtually achieved parity now, which is great. So the overall message today was clear, and that is we're going to continue to pursue good policy based on California values. And yes, as is reflected in the fact that we also gaveled in a special session, and we can talk a little bit about the details of that. We're also on high alert for ways where we can defend those values, ensure that we're continuing with our progress against the likely efforts of Trump to undermine that.
All right, we're speaking with Assemblymember Damon Connolly, 12th California Assembly District from Sausalito to Santa Rosa. We also have San Francisco City Attorney David Chu on the line. Assemblymember Connolly, what was your sense of what the governor's top priority is in terms of confronting Trump administration policies and, as you say, sort of defending California values? And by extension, what are your priorities here?
Yeah, and it requires a little speculation on our part. And obviously, we're hearing a lot of concern from the communities we represent. We already have the fact that the incoming administration has threatened disaster relief funding for the state if we don't bend the proverbial knee to policies they want to pursue that would be against things that we're strongly in favor of. We know that last time around, we saw separation of families. We saw demonization of immigrant communities in the state. And I, for one, and I know City Attorney Chu will agree, I know all of our colleagues agree, we're not going to stand for that. We're going to, as a governor well stated, have the backs of our immigrant communities, all of our residents, and we'll go toe-to-toe as necessary to protect those values.
And Assembly Member Connolly, just staying with you on this, I want to talk about reproductive rights on the campaign trail. Former President, now incoming President-elect Trump, said he would not support a national abortion ban, and yet he surrounded himself with a lot of people who do want such a national ban. And he could certainly make it very difficult to get access to abortion for women, even in blue states. He could try to restrict access to mifepristone, for example, or issue an executive order establishing personhood to unborn fetuses. I'm just wondering what you are expecting. I know, as you said, we have to play the guessing game here a little bit, but what are you thinking is most likely to come out of this administration on reproductive rights?
Well, it's hard to say at this point. Obviously, I don't feel we can take what's being said at face value. If you look at Project 2025, it states clearly what they intend to do. And now he's surrounding himself with folks who effectively drafted that document. So again, I think California is in the posture of we have enshrined abortion rights in our state constitution. We are a sanctuary state for people seeking reproductive care from other states and frankly from around the world. That will continue. Let me provide you with a couple of specifics though, Ethan, on what the governor has in mind. And it's specifically the allocation of $25 million to a legal defense fund to defend California's investments against the president-elect's incoming administration. So these are budget requests. There has been legislation now introduced, so-called crossing the desk. We adjourned today. The legislature will be back in session full time in January, and these bills will be taken up. So we can provide more specifics if you'd like for your listeners. But really, this is for defending California in litigation challenging actions taken. It will enable funding of proactive litigation efforts, and that's something City Attorney Chu is well acquainted with. So that is, it's a fairly narrow focus right now, but I think an important one. And I can say as a former deputy attorney general for the state myself, those kind of lawsuits will be crucial to defend the kind of values we're talking about. I believe the figure is California literally filed about 100 lawsuits against the first Trump administration. Most of those, or certainly many of those, successfully.
Absolutely. California, certainly, and others, blue states as well, did have quite a successful litigation track record. So it makes sense to see the governor and you and your colleagues in the legislature make sure that there's a litigation fund to set aside. I do want to talk about immigration. You mentioned it, the state of California being a sanctuary state. And in the past, San Francisco has declared itself a sanctuary city. So for City Attorney David Chu, I'm wondering if San Francisco, how you would expect San Francisco public officials to handle a request for cooperation this time around from the Immigration Customs and Enforcement Agency, or ICE.
Well, unfortunately, we know we're going to be faced again with a president-elect who has demonized immigrants, who has relished in hatred and division and targeting those communities that make up the bedrock of California, of our country, of our economy, and those are our immigrant families, those are our immigrant workers. My office, during the first Trump administration, we had dozens of legal matters that challenged the first Trump 4 years. And in particular, we led on four major lawsuits that related to our immigrant communities, particularly and including one of his first executive orders that threatened sanctuary cities. He threatened to withdraw federal funding from sanctuary cities. We challenged that in the courts. We won at the district court level. We were upheld at the Ninth Circuit. And when Biden came back into office, his Department of Justice dropped its appeal. So we effectively won on that issue, but we certainly expect that Donald Trump will yet again do whatever he can to try to deputize our local law enforcement, our police officers, our sheriffs, as arms of his mass deportation forces. And from our perspective, our local law enforcement ought to be focused on actual public safety within our communities, of ensuring that there's trust within our entire set of diverse communities. If he tries to move forward with that again, of course, we will meet him in the legal context as well as others.
Well, City Attorney Chu, I know in addition to the lawsuit that you just mentioned, there was another lawsuit that San Francisco brought against the former Trump administration 1.0, to block changes to the, quote, public charge rule, which sought to impose a wealth test on immigrants that are applying for residency. Do you expect the second Trump administration to try something similar? And would there be ongoing litigation as there was in the last administration?
We do think that that is quite likely. If you read Project 2025, there are so many ideas in place on so many fronts. But during the first Trump administration, despite the fact that immigrants pay huge amounts of money into government coffers, Donald Trump tried to establish a wealth test for immigrants to be able to access basic social services. We brought a lawsuit along with Santa Clara County to block the Trump administration from implementing this rule. We were successful in getting a preliminary injunction. Courts across the country unanimously agreed that this Trump rule was unlawful, that it was unconstitutional, prohibited it from being implemented. And again, it took President Biden coming into office after 2020 to rescind that rule. But I would not be surprised at all if he tried to bring that back, if Donald Trump tried to bring that back during his second term.
We'll have to wait and see what happens, but it does seem likely. Want to let listeners know, if you're just joining us, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're discussing the potential impact of the next Trump administration on life here in the Bay Area. And we're joined by State Assemblymember Damon Connolly of the 12th Assembly District in Marin County, as well as San Francisco City Attorney David Chu. And we'd love to hear from you. What issues or concerns are on your mind when you think about this incoming Trump 2.0 administration and what that might mean for life here in the Bay Area? You can give us a call. Our phone lines are open. We are at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also find us on social media or email any questions you have at stateofthebay@kalw.org. And we do have an email question in from Eli, who asks, what effect Elon Musk might have on the Trump administration in regards to green technology, solar, electric cars, climate change, et cetera, as it seems he might be pushing an agenda that is not in line with the traditional pro-oil and anti-climate message of the GOP and Trump. Well, Eli, thank you for that question. Assemblymember Connolly, I guess this is more trying to read the tea leaves, but any sense that maybe Trump might moderate a small amount on clean technology, or maybe the market's changed since the first Trump administration? Just your take on that.
I think it's doubtful. It'll be interesting to kind of see the shelf life of the first buddy, shall we say. I think there's some speculation around that. That having been said, obviously there is some inherent tension there. Obviously, on one hand, we're in a state that's kind of taken the leadership in transitioning to a clean vehicle future, clean energy future. Elon Musk, to some extent, has been part of that. Trump, literally, everything he's been saying and doing is diametrically opposed to that. I mean, pick your poison, whether it's, seemingly a war against electric vehicle infrastructure or offshore wind or enhanced rail. We certainly have doubts that Mr. Musk will have any sort of positive impact on him.
All right, so you're not holding your breath on that, and I think with evidence to support you, but I like the first buddy term for Elon Musk. Those two seem to be joined at the hip from all the photos coming out of Mar-a-Lago. Assemblymember Connolly wanted to also ask you about immigration, and of course, California does have a lot to lose if there is a big mass deportation, undocumented immigrants. According to a study by the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, pay around $8.5 billion in local and state taxes in California every year. And of course, they support a lot of well-paying jobs here in the Bay Area with these lower-paid workers, the nannies, housekeepers, gardeners, restaurant, construction workers, et cetera, not to mention in-home nursing care. So a lot of labor force that the Bay Area in particular relies on. I'm wondering, what are the thoughts about what the state could do? I heard from City Attorney Chu on what San Francisco might be gearing up to do and did last time, but what can California do in the face of these mass deportation plans and threats?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, we will go to bat and do whatever it takes to fight for families. As you said, our immigrant communities are front and center locally in terms of folks who are doing work in our communities. Our kids are in schools. We had one case, for example, in my district during Trump 1.0, where there was a father who was simply undocumented, but had been in the country for a considerable amount of time, was at work, kids in school, no criminal record, and was picked up and threatened with deportation. So the community mobilized, we went to bat, and we were able to fight it that way. Mr. Chu mentioned in terms of cooperation with local law enforcement, that's still a huge issue. You may recall several years ago, the state passed Senate Bill 54, the California Values Act, which significantly restricts how local law enforcement can interact with ICE. Namely, it prohibits it except in cases such as a serious or violent felony. So I think enforcing those kind of laws, there were other important protections for our immigrant communities that are still on the books in the state. Again, that goes back to enforcing all these state laws. But the main thing, and I think the governor, again, reemphasized this, is creating a clear message that our immigrant communities are valued, that they are part of our communities, and that we're going to stand with them.
And City Attorney Chu, we heard Assemblymember Connolly talk about the $25 million that the special session has produced to cover litigation costs by the state of California, either defending California policies or challenging Trump 2.0 administration policies. Is any of that money coming to your office? What are your resources to gear up for what is likely to be an onslaught of policies and litigation that's going to be needed for the city of San Francisco?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, our office, we had dozens of legal matters challenging many aspects of the first Trump administration and doing that successfully. Among different things we talked about, we joined cities and states around the country in challenging the inclusion of a citizenship question on the 2020 U.S. Census. If that had actually been in place, it could have cost California literally billions of dollars for a state that sends far more money to Washington, D.C. than we actually receive in turn. So it's really critical that all of our offices are resourced. My understanding, I very much appreciate Governor Newsom's proposal to move forward with funding. I understand that the proposal that was put out today is specific to the Attorney General's office, and I certainly know that that is an office that needs to get that funding. But those of us that are part of local city attorney, county council offices around the state that were very involved in litigation during the first 4 years of Trump, we are also asking the administration as well as the legislature for resources in this area as well, and want to thank the Senate, who today introduced a bill that would provide offices like ours funding in this space, and want to say to my good friend Damon Connolly, hope to have a conversation with the Assembly about doing the same. I know it's the first day of the special session, but the fact of the matter is, it is all hands on deck. We are going to need everyone who is able to stand up and stand with our communities who are going to be targeted, whether it be reproductive rights or our LGBTQ communities or healthcare access or immigrant families or climate change. We're going to be having to defend our state on so many fronts. And so much of what happens when it comes to government happens at the local level, happens in cities and happens in counties, which is why many of our city attorneys and county councils were asking for resources so that we can play the role that we need to play in defending major portions of civil society throughout the state of California.
And just briefly, City Attorney Chu, how much money do you think is needed? What's the budget ask for a city like San Francisco here?
Well, so we literally spent millions of dollars during the first Trump term, and appreciate the state Senate for proposing $10 million for city attorneys and county councils around the state to be able to do the same. The fact of the matter is, it's our cities and counties that are running our local public hospitals, our county jail system, are receiving and providing local grants and local contracts, all of which could come under attack by the Trump administration. When Donald Trump issued his unconstitutional executive order vis-a-vis cities that held pro-immigrant policies, it would have directly impacted local jurisdictions and could have cut off billions of dollars of funding across the state. And so it was up to our local jurisdictions to be able to stand up for that. We're going to be working very closely with our attorney general and with our counterparts around the country, but we need to make sure that we've got enough resources for this all hands on deck moment.
If you're just joining us, this is State of the Bay on local public radio, 91.7 KALW Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're talking about the potential impact of Trump 2.0 on the Bay Area. We're joined by San Francisco City Attorney David Chu and Assembly Member Damon Connolly from the 12th Assembly District in Marin County. We'd love to hear from you as well. You can give us a call if you have thoughts or concerns about what might happen. We're at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can find us on social media, or you can send us an email at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Well, Assemblymember Connolly, we just heard City Attorney Chu talk about some of the funding needs and potential cuts that we might be seeing from the federal government. And one area where there's been a lot of talk about cuts has been in education. Donald Trump has made statements about shutting down the Department of Education, putting education back in the hands of states, as he says. And I'm just curious to hear from you, Assemblymember Connolly, what is on the radar for the legislature about protecting education funding in California and what that might mean, the federal policies there might mean for the state's educational system?
Absolutely. Great question. And it was great to see our superintendent, Tony Thurmond, come out strongly once President-elect Trump mentioned that he was seeking to actually do away with the federal education department. So I think we're united as a state. Again, it's a little bit speculation at this point, but not really. So I think it's going to be a matter of continuing to work with all our local school districts to make sure that they have the funding they need. Our own budget picture, no news to anyone, is pretty mixed right now as a state. I guess the good news is it looks like the projected deficit is less than what we had anticipated. That having been said, that becomes even more dire if we're talking about major federal cuts. So again, working with colleagues, working with our federal representatives, we need to continue to push back and try to ensure that that money continues to flow to our communities. That's but one example, right? We're talking about Trump proposed rollbacks on the Inflation Reduction Act. That's where you talk about major cuts to things like electric vehicle charging infrastructure, which is crucial. We're a little bit more optimistic on the bipartisan federal infrastructure law that was passed a couple years ago, ensuring that things like Highway 37, right up in my neck of the woods, continue to get the attention they need, both from an environmental and a transportation standpoint as well. So, yeah, I think it's just going to be continuing to go to bat to ensure that our communities get the federal funding they're entitled to, and then continue as a state to think proactively, such as when the voters just passed the climate bond, Proposition 4. So kind of taking matters into our own hands in a way that protects infrastructure funding, good paying jobs, and keeps California in the lead on a lot of these values we've been talking about.
Yeah. Well, and just briefly, Assembly Member Connolly, just have a few minutes left. What about healthcare? What are you gearing up for in terms of any changes to healthcare policy?
That remains to be seen. I think the immediate issue, and I think City Attorney Chu highlighted it, is things around, for example, health care coverage of immigrants, notwithstanding their documentation status. I think we proudly offer that coverage here. The public charge issues are likely to rear their heads again. So I think, again, high alert as to what educated guesses suggest will be coming our way.
And we do have an email question in from Marie, who writes, what can't the new Trump administration touch in California and San Francisco? And won't Congress's actions or inaction impact us as well? City Attorney Chu, is there, I guess, good news here in terms of avoiding federal interference? What are the things that are hopefully going to stay the same if they're working well at the city level, at least?
Well, in the U.S. Constitution, the 10th Amendment says that if powers aren't explicitly given to the federal government, they're reserved for the state and also our local governments. And so there are many areas. The whole purpose of state governments and local governments is to set policies where the feds either don't have the ability to act or have not acted. And so that will certainly be a major line in the sand when it comes to what the Trump administration tries to do and where we're able to defend. But one thing that is unfortunately different about today than during the last Trump administration is because of the November election, Trump has majority control over the Senate and the House of Representatives, which does create a much more dangerous situation where if laws aren't on the books that allow the federal government to do certain things, they could try to move other really pernicious laws. So, you know, talk about healthcare. Trump and his Republican allies have talked about repealing, rolling back, weakening the Affordable Care Act in very significant ways. Talk about education. Trump has talked about eliminating the Department of Education, has talked about empowering for-profit colleges that have taken advantage of low-income students. There are just so many fronts that are hard to anticipate right now of what a Republican-controlled Congress may do. So this is why it is so important for folks to just continue, as demoralized as folks are at this point, we got to pick ourselves up and continue to engage in the political process, in the policy process, in the courts, because so much of what our state is about and our country is about, given Trump's disdain for the rule of law, given the plans in Project 2025, we need to do whatever we can to defend our state, our constitution, and the laws of this country.
And just briefly, City Attorney Chu, the federal judiciary has changed since Trump 1.0. It's more conservative, certainly at the Supreme Court level. Are you worried about how that might impact lawsuits from cities like yours in San Francisco?
It's very much a concern because Trump was able to pack not just the U.S. Supreme Court, but the federal judiciary at the trial court level, at the appellate level. And those of us that have the ability to bring lawsuits and defend lawsuits, we certainly have an eye to this chain judiciary as we're thinking about the arguments that we're putting forth and the cases that we need to make.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you both so much for joining us on State of the Bay. Obviously, a lot more to talk about. And as the Trump administration takes power in January, we may have to have you both back on for an update. But San Francisco City Attorney David Chu and Assemblymember Damon Connolly representing Marin County, thank you both so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us on.
And coming up next, we're going to hear producer Ann Harper's conversation with Louisa Smith, buying director for Book Passage, about the best new books for the book lovers on your holiday shopping list. So stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Rose Aguilar, host of Your Call. Join us on Mondays at 7 p.m. for an ongoing series on Project 2025. This Heritage Foundation-led plan lays out an agenda to transform the country into a Christian nation. Project 2025 would dismantle the administrative state and ensure arch-conservative rule for decades to come. It would affect all aspects of life and would be implemented by expanding presidential powers and eliminating federal agencies. Join us on Mondays at 7 p.m. here on KALW.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ann Harper. Tonight, we have a special guest who's going to help us with the book lovers on our holiday gift lists. We have Louisa Smith, buying director for Book Passage, an independent bookstore in Corte Madera and the San Francisco Ferry Building. Welcome to State of the Bay, Louisa.
Thank you so much, Ann.
So the holiday shopping season is already in full swing, and we all have book lovers on our lists. Tell us about some of your favorite new titles this year. Let's start with fiction. A lot of people are seeking escape from reality right now. What new titles might carry us away?
Well, the biggest new title and the most exciting one probably of the year is James by Percival Everett, which just won the National Book Award. At Book Passage, we have this special program called the First Edition Club, where we get an author to sign a limited number of books that we share with the club. We try to pick up-and-coming authors, so usually we pick debuts. Every once in a while, we break from this because the book is just too good that even though this author is known, everybody should read it. And we pick James for this because it is a reimagining of the tale of Huckleberry Finn, but told from the perspective of the most interesting character in the book, Jim, or as he prefers to be called, James. It's a rich book. And the book that this character deserves. It'll make you want to reread Huck Finn. It shows you all the things you love about Huck Finn, but it's such a modern, fresh take on it. It's a real tour de force. Then shifting quite dramatically to something, because as you said, people want to escape. And one of the most delightful and charming books of the year is a little book called Sipsworth by Simon Van Bui.
Sipsworth?
Yes, like sipping tea. There is a woman who is in her 80s, who's returned home after decades of being away, just wait out the end of her life and cut herself off from everybody else. As she likes to describe herself, standing in the queue for her exit. One night, some of her neighbors have put out some free items and she wants to rummage through them. She brings them inside and mistakenly introduces a mouse to her house, which initially she wants to trap and put outside, but no, the cat might get it. She's sure that this must have been a pet mouse, not a wild mouse. Over time, she actually starts caring for the mouse, and it reconnects her to the world. It's such a beautiful and charming book. It's just an absolute delight and a real Christmas kind of feel.
Great. Are there any others? I know you're a fan of mysteries.
I am. Oh, I love mysteries. One that's juicy and dark and delicious is one called Lightborn by Philip Hessing. And it is the story of Christopher Marlowe, the famous playwright, and he's been thrown into jail, and the person that gets him out, he's not sure whether or not he's the person he can trust. And it's just a way of incorporating history and romance and mystery and intrigue. It's a wonderful, delightful book. So I love Lightborn.
Nice.
I felt like I was smarter at the end of it, too.
I love that. All right. And for those who might still insist on understanding our reality a little bit better, what are your new favorite nonfiction titles?
Oh, nonfiction. One that I'm really excited about is called Forbidden Garden, The Botanists of Besieged Leningrad and Their Impossible Choice. It's by Simon Porkin. And this book takes place during the siege of Leningrad, during World War II. And there was a seed bank. And the people that were in charge of the seed bank had to make the choice whether or not to eat the seeds or to starve. These are remarkable people with a very difficult choice. So I think given what's happening in Ukraine, given what's happening with climate change, given what's happening with all of us and the choices we make these days, it's a really fitting read. And these people are just unsung heroes. So I love that. Another one that I found just to be wonderfully escapist, even though it is in reality, is Walk in the Park by Kevin Federico. He did the 800-mile walk across the Grand Canyon with a photographer. There are fewer people that have done this hike than have walked on the moon.
Wow.
It's remarkable. It is incredibly dangerous. Now, you could die from the heat, from exposure, from flooding, from falling, from all sorts of things. I believe the photographer is the one that actually came up with the idea, so it's all photographed along the way. And they have these death-defying adventures as they make this incredible hike across this terrain unlike any other terrain in the world. It's for people that read Cheryl Strayed or Bill Bryson. There's humor in it, as it is when things are falling apart. And just brand new, as of last Tuesday, the new biography by the German Chancellor, Freedom, Memoirs 1954 to 2021, Angela Merkel. She's a remarkable woman. She is not holding back any of her thoughts about the other players from when she was in politics, which is fascinating because she talks about Putin, she talks about Trump, she talks about Biden, she talks about all the people that she worked with, all the struggles that she has, but it also looks at her personal life and how she got to where she is. It's a really terrific political memoir, and I read very few of those, and I thoroughly recommend this.
Perfect. Are there any classics you find yourself restocking year after year? I have a friend who likes to gift copies of Wallace Stegner's Crossing to Safety, which is a classic story about deep friendship. Are there other classics that you find yourself having to restock?
There's always A Child's Christmas in Wales by Dylan Thomas that we have to bring in. But the one that I think that is more specific to independent bookstores in California would be Braiding Sweetgrass. Every year we bring in Braiding Sweetgrass, which talks about reconnecting ourselves to the world. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful book. And the wonderful thing this year is that she actually has a new book, and she hasn't had a new book in years. It's tiny. I believe it's under 100 pages long. It's illustrated. Oh. And it's called The Service Berry. The author is Robin Wall Kimmerer.
Wonderful. And what about the kids on our lists? Are there new books for young children that you'd recommend or for the teens in our lives?
Absolutely. Well, first I'm going to tell you the one that I think is the most hysterical, which is called We Are Definitely Human. It's a picture book. So you can read it to a three-year-old. You can read it up to a seven-year-old.
Okay.
Because the humor is, all of them will get it. It is in the middle of a night. There's a crash outside in the farm, spacecraft had landed. The farmer goes out there. He meets these sort of peculiar looking people. He asks them and they say, we are definitely human. So he's not sure about it, but you know, he's being very friendly, invites them in. They explain to his wife that they are from Europe and they need to fix their craft. And now the whole town is coming together to fix it with these very odd creatures. When people ask them, like, what do you do? One of them says, I do office. You know, I wear hats. That is a very funny book about a community pulling together and these odd people who fly off into the air at the end. And the farmer looks and says, well, they are definitely not from Europe. I mean, if you've had kids, you know, you have to read these books over and over. Right. This is the book that will keep you amused as well as your kids.
Fantastic.
For older kids, Jandy Nelson has written a YA book that honestly, I think adults could read as well. It'd be perfect for book clubs. It's about a family. It's in Northern California in the wine country in a magical little town. And a young girl comes to town with multicolored hair and all these stories start unfolding. It is a family saga. It is magical realism. And it's really about the families we make, the stories we tell ourselves about those families, and finally opening up and becoming honest with those around us about who we really are. It's really beautiful. Jandy Nelson is the author. I just think she's done something remarkable with this book.
Wonderful. Well, we'll have to leave it there. We'll have a link on the State of the Bay website where our listeners can find these books and can find them at your local independent bookstore. So thanks so much for joining us, Louisa Smith.
Thank you so much, Anne. And tomorrow, we'll be having an event at our Corte Madera store at 11 a.m. we call it our All-Star Booksellers Book Talk. It's on the best books for the holidays. It will be streamed as well as being in person. So if you go to the Books Passage website, you can find the link and watch it from your home.
Fantastic. All right. Thanks again, Louisa, and thanks for being on State of the Bay.
Thank you, Anne.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We hope you'll join us next Monday at 6 when my co-host Grace Wan talks about reproductive rights with Assemblymember Mia Bonta. For more information about tonight's show, you can visit our State of the Bay page on KALW.org. And please remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen so that you never miss an episode. If you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, just email us anytime at stateofthebay@KALW.org. Tonight's show was produced by Ann Harper. It was engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor was our board operator. I'm Ethan Elkind. Good night, and thanks for listening.